Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, who examines the proposed Trump GOP tax reform plan's major cuts to Medicare and reductions in Social Security benefits through changes in the Consumer Price Index. Art Tandarup, a Nebraska farmer and activist with the anti-Keystone XL pipeline group Bold Nebraska, who reflects on state regulators' recent approval of the pipeline project, maintaining that the fight is far from over. And Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, who explains why there's growing opposition to FCC moves that will allow the right-wing Sinclair TV network to merge with Tribune Media. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On November 6th, the Trump administration announced that in January 2019, it will end temporary protected status, or TPS, that was given to 5,300 Nicaraguan immigrants that protects them from deportation. The White House also said the program would be extended for some 86,000 Honduran immigrants until July 2018, but added it could then be terminated. Thousands of Nicaraguans and Hondurans were given the special status in 1999 after Hurricane Mitch devastated Central America. On November 20th, the Trump administration also announced 59,000 Haitians living in the U.S. must leave within 18 months. Brooklyn Congresswoman Yvette Clark is leading a bipartisan drive to give a total of 300,000 people with temporary protected status in the United States an opportunity to win permanent residency. Representative Clark is co-sponsoring what's called the Aspire Act, along with Miami Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton and Seattle Democrat Pramila Jayapal. The bill would provide permanent residency to anyone who had been granted TPS as of January 2017. An overwhelming majority of Central Americans living in the U.S. on TPS are employed full-time and made major contributions to the U.S. economy through payment of income and property taxes, Social Security and Medicare contributions, job creation, and spending. The Center for American Progress estimates the termination of temporary protected status would cost the U.S. economy $164 billion over a decade. Amid continuing fallout from the 2016 Brexit vote, there is growing concern in Britain over allegations of covert Russian influence in UK elections, with a discovery of over 400 fake Twitter accounts run by the Russian Internet Research Agency. According to the Guardian newspaper, Russian-based social media trolls sought to exploit ethnic divisions in the United Kingdom as citizens voted over their future relationship with the European Union. After this year's March terrorist attack on Westminster Bridge, one of the Kremlin-linked accounts sought to stir up anti-Muslim anger. Fake social media posts like this were picked up by mainstream newspapers, including the Daily Mail and The Sun. Conservative and Labour members of Parliament are putting pressure on Twitter and Facebook to identify the phony accounts used to influence the Brexit vote. Many of the fake pro-Brexit Twitter accounts from Russia purported to be from conservative Americans, including a U.S. Navy War veteran and a Republican from Tennessee. While Russian President Vladimir Putin denied any attempt to influence the Brexit referendum, Western analysts say Putin will benefit from a weakened EU, which will be more reluctant to impose economic sanctions against Russia for past and future aggression, such as the annexation of Crimea. For the past 8 months, 1,800 former Time Warner Cable employees in New York City have been on strike over a contract dispute with Charter Communications. Union activists say Charter is trying to eliminate valued benefits. For years, Local 3 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers had a good relationship with Time Warner, which provided quality health insurance coverage and a generous 401k retirement plan. However, when Charter bought Time Warner Cable in May 2016 and absorbed it under its Spectrum Cable and Internet arm, the relationship soured. Charter, which employs some 90,000 people across the U.S., moved to switch its Time Warner Cable employees over to their boilerplate contract with much fewer benefits, triggering the strike. Under Time Warner, Workers enjoyed low co-pays and premiums for major medical expenses, and the union leadership says it's not ready to give up on quality health benefits for their members to end the strike. Meanwhile, many striking workers must rely on food pantry donations to make ends meet and struggle to pay rent and mortgages, with a looming threat for some of homelessness. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
According to the calculations of many economists, President Trump and the Republicans' proposed tax reform legislation, which passed in the House November 16th and now moves to the Senate, will primarily benefit the top 1% of wealthiest Americans and not the middle class as advertised. In fact, by some estimates, 80% of the benefits from GOP tax reductions and tax code changes would go to people making more than $730,000 a year over the next decade. Other features of the Republican tax plan include elimination of the estate tax that only benefits couples with more than $11 million in assets, ending most tax deductions for college students, dropping deductions for state and local taxes, predominantly hurting blue state residents, and repeal of the Obamacare individual mandate in the Senate version of the tax bill that will result in 13 million Americans losing their health insurance coverage. But while many of the effects of the GOP tax reform plan operate like Robin Hood in reverse, another set of negative consequences for average Americans relates to little-discussed cuts in the federal social safety net. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the GOP tax bill will instantly trigger $400 billion in automatic cuts to Medicare over the next 10 years, including a $25 billion reduction in the first year after enactment. Your reporter spoke with Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, who examines the proposed Trump GOP tax plan's major cuts to Medicare and the likelihood that something called chain CPI will be imposed through the tax bill, increasing taxes and reducing Social Security benefits.
The Republicans have really just one play in their playbook that they've been using over and over again since January 1, and that is what they want to do is give tax breaks to their billionaire donors. And they, in the process, even though they say there will be cuts to middle class, many middle class families will see their taxes increase. The way they want to pay for those huge tax cuts for the very wealthy is by cutting vital programs. They want to really end Medicare and Medicaid as we know it. They have had a vendetta against Social Security really since the time it's been enacted. And what they did over the summer with Trump Care was they were really going to destroy Medicaid, get rid of the Affordable Care Act, and use that to pay for big tax cuts. And now they're just doing that in reverse order. They passed a budget that has big cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and tax breaks for the very wealthy. They've now passed through the House a tax cut bill that will by itself automatically trigger what CBO calls $400 billion of cuts in Medicare over the next decade. People are not really talking about it, but as soon as the tax bill gets passed, unless they waive another provision of an existing law, there will be $400 billion of cuts in Medicare. They also wanted, in the Senate version, repeal a part of Obamacare that, again, CBO projects will cut $185 billion out of Medicaid.
Nancy, with these hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts that may come out of Medicare, what will the net effect be on Medicare recipients down the line? How will it affect them personally?
Well, I think one way it may affect them is their choice of doctor. All these cuts in reimbursement of doctors and so forth, a lot of doctors may decide that it's not in their economic interest to keep seeing Medicare patients, and Medicare patients can wind up not being able to go to the hospitals they want, not being able to go to the doctors they want. The problem is that if this bill passes, it automatically triggers these cuts, and the person in charge of figuring out how to implement the cuts will be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. That's a man by the name of Mick Mulvaney, who is an extreme conservative who has a longstanding hatred of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and he will be in charge of deciding how the Medicare cuts come about. And as a consequence, I'm concerned that he will come up with the most destructive ways possible because he wants to see this program ended.
And Nancy, before we go, I wanted to make sure to talk about another situation that's waiting in the wings here, again, not being much discussed, and that is there's a proposal by the Republicans to include something called chain CPI in the final tax legislation, which could increase taxes for many Americans, but also mean future reductions in Social Security benefits. Tell our listeners a bit about chain CPI. I'm sure many haven't heard about it.
It is an absolute tax increase, and it does have this potential for Social Security, as you mentioned. One of the big advantages of Social Security over private pension plans is that the benefits are indexed, so they don't erode over time. As inflation goes up, the benefits go up, so the purchasing power is maintained. Now, the same thing is true on the tax side, that the brackets are indexed so that if you're getting more dollars, but it's the real value of that money is not increasing, you don't pay a higher percentage in taxes, which is why the brackets are indexed. When they first decided to have automatic increases in 1972, there was only one index available. That was the consumer price index for workers. And so that was used. Now, of course, retirees, people who get Social Security, are by definition not workers, yet that was the only index that was available then. The current inflation adjustment, the CPIW as it's called, for Social Security is inadequate because seniors and people with disabilities have disproportionately large expenditures on health care, and health care costs have risen much more rapidly than other costs. So there's another index called CPIE, the Consumer Price Index for Elderly, that is a better measure. But instead of going for the CPIE, in order to save money, politicians a few years ago said, well, let's use a stingier index, and that's this chain CPI. They're now saying, well, let's use the stingier index for taxes, and that will cause middle class and working class people to pay higher income taxes. And what many fear is that once they get a foothold on the taxes, it'll be easy to say, well, we're using it for this, let's use it for Social Security too. And that would be a cut in Social Security benefits.
That was Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, chair of the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, and author of The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. For more analysis on the GOP tax reform bill's impact on working families, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 16th, at least 210,000 gallons of tar sands oil spilled in South Dakota from the Keystone Pipeline. The pipeline, owned by TransCanada, is the same company that's trying to build yet another pipeline, the infamous Keystone XL, which, if built, would bring tar sands oil from indigenous lands in Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas for likely export. The spill occurred just days before Nebraska's Public Service Commission had to rule on TransCanada's application for the KXL through the state. The project, which was denied a permit by President Obama in 2015, was revived by an executive order signed by Donald Trump in one of his first official acts in office. On November 20th, the Public Service Commission announced their approval of the pipeline by a 3-2 vote, but changed 60% of the route through Nebraska, which means the company must now deal with a whole new set of challenges. Another major obstacle for the company is that the price of oil has dropped by more than 50% since TransCanada first proposed the project over a decade ago. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Art Tanderup, a Nebraska farmer and member of Bold Nebraska, a group that's been fighting the pipeline through legal challenges, grassroots organizing, and the construction of several solar-powered buildings along the proposed pipeline route. Here, Tanderup, whose farm is located on both the earlier and newly approved route, maintains that despite the commission decision, the fight is far from over.
We're disappointed in the decision that it wasn't a total rejection, obviously. However, TransCanada did not get their preferred route. And in the application process, part of that process requires two alternative routes. So they had put the first route that they had tried several years ago and was rejected, as well as they came up with this alternative one, and the Public Service Commission chose to go to this alternate route. However, it still crosses the eastern sandhills up here through the most porous soils where the Ogallala Aquifer will be most directly impacted if there's a spill. We have a situation that now is going to require TransCanada to make a decision. What do they do next? Nobody was smiling when they came out of that hearing yesterday, and their statements from corporate are pretty indecisive. They need money to build this, and they also need suppliers. And they don't have either of those yet. And the decision that was made yesterday is going to increase the amount of money that they need. For example, on the preferred route that they've been trying to get, they already have purchased land for substations. They have a lot of easements purchased. A lot of infrastructure has already been put in place, even though they have no permits for this. So consequently, nothing has been done on this other route. They haven't talked to any of these landowners, a whole bunch of new landowners, seven more counties they have to go through, four pumping stations that they've had no preparation for. Even though it wasn't a total victory, it was a win. So another thing that they can do is they could appeal the decision that was made. They could appeal that, which would go to a district court, which would be in front of one judge. Whatever that one judge decides would then probably go forth to the Nebraska Supreme Court. If they decide to work with what the Public Service Commission approved, then we're looking, I think, at least 3 to 5 years, legal challenges, etc. And time is obviously on our side with tar sands pipelines, because every day, every year, is one step closer to more renewable energy, and we don't need the dirty fossil fuels.
Art Tanderup, just days before the Public Service Commission in Nebraska had to make this decision, there was a huge oil spill along the Keystone Pipeline, also owned by TransCanada, which has been in operation for several years, at least 210,000 gallons. And a lot of us thought that that would actually help move the decision to a denial of the permit to build the KXL. And then I learned that there's a law in Nebraska since 2011 that prevents the commission from even considering safety issues when considering these pipeline applications.
This is politics at work in its finest, where you have TransCanada who influences people who make the laws and who write the rules. And so that is something they got in there. They also have in their rules that they can't go through the porous soils like we have on my farm. There's another part of it that talks about threats to natural resources. And in Nebraska, that aquifer is our greatest resource. So this pipeline is a threat. Even though you can't talk about spills, that pipeline is still a threat to that natural resource. So it gets very tricky. You know, we've been battling that issue all along as we fought this through the Public Service Commission.
That was Art Tanderup, a Nebraska farmer and activist with the group Bold Nebraska. For more news and perspectives on the fight to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On a 3-2 party line vote on November 16th, the Federal Communications Commission voted to eliminate a series of decades-old regulations that will now allow broadcasters to merge with newspapers in the same market and could permit companies to own two of the top four stations in a city. If they survive an expected court challenge and opposition by consumers, the rules will usher in a new era of concentration of media ownership that critics charge will harm the diversity of views heard on the air and read in print. The major beneficiary of the FCC's deregulation is Sinclair Broadcast Group, the conservative television corporation seeking to buy Tribune Media Company, that owns 42 stations, for $3.9 billion. If the Tribune Media merger goes forward, Sinclair would own a total of 223 TV stations serving 108 markets, including 39 of the top 50, which reach about 72% of all U.S. households. Sinclair, which already is the nation's largest TV station group owner, has a reputation for forcing local stations to air conservative commentaries and run stories with a right-wing bias on the local news. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press. Here he discusses why he believes the recent FCC vote that removes limits on media ownership will harm the public interest, and indications that the Trump administration may have struck a special deal with Sinclair to approve the merger in exchange for favorable political coverage.
Yeah, it really is a scandalous set of activities being carried out by the Federal Communications Commission. There are longstanding rules on the books that haven't changed at all since the early 2000s, and really the majority has been held in place since the late 90s, going back in some cases back to the 1970s, limits put on how many television stations one company can own in a market, just how big a footprint one company can have when it comes to local news. And as we know, still the biggest sources for local news are those local broadcasters, your daily newspaper, even in the internet age, when it comes to who's actually got reporters out there doing stories, looking what's happening in the community. It's really dominated by these local outlets. And so the FCC has long had rules saying, hey, we can't have more than one company owning too much media in one market. And there's going to be limits on how many TV stations, what the reach of those TV stations is anyway, across the country as a whole. But ever since the Trump administration came in and the GPI, they've been hammering away at these longstanding limits. And so just last week, they actually voted in a really, unfortunately, sorely undercovered vote to get rid of a bunch of the rules, all designed to benefit this company, Sinclair. There's no question about it. Sinclair has been one of the companies that's been pushing hardest to change these rules, that's been coming up with ways to evade them, and they've now convinced the FCC to do away with the rules that are standing in their way, and in some cases actually reinstate rules that the Obama administration got rid of that were putting limits on how much they could own. So it's a situation where now there is nothing standing in the way of a single television company like Sinclair outright owning two or three stations in a market, no matter how small it is. They've changed the standard by which they would consider waivers among the top-rated stations. So you could own, CBS and ABC or NBC and Fox. That had been prohibited. Now they'll look at it on a case-by-case basis. They've also blessed these so-called sidecar arrangements where a company essentially runs the news operations of one of the other stations. So you're now looking at a situation where one company could control maybe five or six television stations in a given market and start to set themselves up where you only really have one or two dominant voices. They also got rid of limits that said you couldn't own the daily newspaper and a television station or a radio station in the same market. They've absolutely wiped that away. And if you listen to what Sinclair and companies like it actually tell their investors, this is their vision. Very little competition. They want to be able to swap stations with other big chains, swallow up the middle-sized chains, and basically dominate in any given community or in a region where you have one company doing most of the news. And when it comes to Sinclair, they've managed to make it even worse because Sinclair is a company that's notorious for slipping conservative and right-wing propaganda into its newscasts.
Describe for our listeners the Sinclair TV operation. who owns it and their political spin applied to local news coverage.
Sure. Sinclair started out as a family-owned station in Baltimore that has rapidly expanded over the last several decades. And the head of the company is a guy named David Smith. It's still in his family. But now they already own more than 170 stations all across the country. If they get this deal done, they'll own more than 230 stations because they're trying to take over Tribune, which owns television stations all across the country, including in the biggest markets, bigger markets than Sinclair's ever been in, like New York and Chicago, Los Angeles. But Sinclair is sort of notorious for pushing a, you know, right-wing or reactionary agenda. You know, they make Fox News look moderate in terms of their political coverage. Now, most of their broadcasts will look to you like any other newscast, you know, sports and weather and, you know, here's something that happened locally, but they force all of their stations all across the country, no matter if it's Seattle or San Antonio or Oklahoma City or Salt Lake City, they force them all to run conservative commentary. There are no liberal commentators, no progressive commentators on Sinclair broadcast, but they force everybody to carry conservative commentary from people like Armstrong Williams, who ran Ben Carson's campaign, and a guy named Boris Epstein, who is a Donald Trump campaign spokesperson, who, you know, on broadcasts across Sinclair stations just about every day is out there to deliver conservative talking points. And they've also slipped this sort of conservative slant into a lot of their newscasts. You might not get it on the local stories, but they now run, you know, essentially a national news operation. Sinclair has been very friendly to the Trump administration. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, suggested that they had a deal with Sinclair for sort of favorable and uncut coverage during the campaign. So now we have a network that essentially operates as Trump TV being offered huge, huge regulatory favors worth billions of dollars, with the FCC leading the way.
That was Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about opposition to the Sinclair Tribune TV merger and the FCC's deregulation of media ownership rules by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.